This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to George Gmelch about his newest book, which is called Playing with Tigers, a minor league chronicle of the 60s. George and I talked, actually, it was 3 years ago. It's amazing how I just couldn't believe it was that long ago, about a previous book. How are you, George?
Good, David. Thanks for having me.
Well, I really enjoyed talking to you about Inside Pitch, which is the book you did a few years ago, which was kind of an anthropology of baseball in the minor leagues. And this, in a way, the new book, Playing with Tigers, is it makes sense as a companion. It's really the book about your time in the minor leagues and your life kind of growing up in the 60s in the context of trying to be a major league baseball player. I thought it was incredibly evocative. I thought it was also really brave of you to expose yourself in so much kind of depth and detail, warts and all. How did you feel about, you know, kind of, I mean, did you think about that you were just showing yourself as you really were in a lot of ways, you know, as a brash young kid making mistakes and, you know, not necessarily doing things the way you wanted to do it?
Well, I thought I had to do that to make a book that was going to be worth reading. And I have friends who've written memoirs and one who teaches memoir writing. And, you know, they recommended it. You tell the warts that, people aren't interested in accounts that gloss over those things. So I did. I mean, my brother read a draft, and he urged me to take a lot of that stuff out. He said, you're going to embarrass the family. But I actually think that those things are very important to tell. It's, you know, it's who I was and who we were as ball players in the 60s, when, you know, the culture was very different and there were a lot more pranks and shenanigans and groupies and that kind of stuff than there are today. This, you mentioned in the earlier book, David, this book actually grows out of that in a weird kind of way. When I did Inside Pitch, an editor told the agent, my agent, have this guy write a memoir. Forget the ethnography, forget the anthropological account. And at the time, I just dismissed it, and I had no interest in even trying to tell my own story, nor did I know how to do that. And it wasn't until, you know, about 4 or 5 years ago, when I was visiting my son in D.C. and happened to pick up a minor league memoir that he had and read it, that all these ideas came flooding back to me. And for three nights in a row, I woke up thinking about my playing days, which I hadn't thought about in a long time, and finally got a tape recorder on the second night and began dictating some of it and began to think about, well, maybe it would be fun and interesting to go back and, you know, relive this and reconnect with old teammates and write a memoir. So, and that's what I wound up doing.
Now, I noticed, and I think that you did say that you had kept, well, I know you kept journals in that period of time, and I wondered if without the journals you would have been able to remember so much or have so many memories, that could be called back from the past. I mean, am I right that having written the journal, going back to reread the journal, was critical for you to be able to, or you just have an incredible memory? Which is it?
No, my memory is no better and maybe worse than most people's. And I mean, people marvel. My teammates and others who read it, you know, they marvel at the detail. And as you say, it would have been impossible without the journal. There were a couple things. The journal was the biggest. And then I had also been writing an occasional feature for a hometown newspaper, which meant that I took notes and I had saved those notes. And then the other really big thing is the internet. Had it not been for the internet, I would not have been able to track down many of my teammates. And then I did interviews with them, and, you know, the journal was the prompt, and then they would, you know, I would bounce ideas off them. Hey, what about this? Do you remember this? And then they would flesh things out or in some cases, not have any recollection at all.
Well, you mentioned that at the end of the book. I thought that was something that is really worth talking about, and that is how the various memories are so different. You know, the things that were really important to you and that made an impact on you were meaningless events to others, that, you know, others of people who were there who participated in those events couldn't even remember them, or they remembered a completely different story in a certain way than you did. And I just thought that was so interesting. You know, even in a group of people sharing a set of experiences that are really kind of heightened experience because they're, you know, you're outside of your normal daily life. When you're playing baseball for a professional team, you're on the road together, you're having all these experiences. And I was just struck by how that seemed to me a really important thing to remember, to think about, that memory is so variable. And that must affect, I mean, we know that storytelling is affected by memory, and also kind of mythology and history. You know, it's, you kind of think about in anthropology, you know, when you study mythology, you're studying essentially storytelling from a culture. But from what we can tell of memory, it really calls into question any kind of factual basis for any memory.
Well, it sure did for me. I was just blown away sometimes at how unreliable my own memory was, and likewise that of some of my teammates. And there were a couple, I mean, probably the most egregious example was I was asking Gene Lamont, who's now the bench coach with the Tigers, about our time together, when I actually thought he was one of my four roommates playing for the Daytona Beach Islanders. And, you know, he looked at me and he said, you know, I wasn't even on that team. And I told him, you're crazy. Of course you were. You were our catcher, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, it turns out he was not on that team that year. I mean, I had spent time with him somewhere else, but not in Daytona Beach. And I had made that mistake with not quite as bad as that, with a couple of other things. So, yeah, it was a big reminder of how unreliable and fallible memory is. There were things, even things that I had done. Several players told a story about how there was a big white sign in center field in this ballpark in Daytona Beach, and how it was very distracting to left-handed hitters because we would lose the pitch in that white sign. And then I went and bought a gallon of green paint and a big brush and went out there at dawn one morning and painted the sign green. Now, I believe that actually happened because three different people told me that story. But I, to this day, have no recollection whatsoever of doing that.
Wow. It does then make the fact that so much baseball is recorded history as statistics really important. You know, even though you might not remember everything that happened accurately or well, you know, it's recorded somewhere, you know, that your statistics are there. The game stories are recorded. Actually, this is an interesting connection. I heard Ron Darling on the radio the other day. He's got a new book out. And I think, I'm not sure, actually didn't catch very much about the book itself, but it's kind of like his memoir, a cathartic story about himself. And one of the things he said was, on the games that he pitched well, he has very little recollection of what he did. But on the games that he did poorly, he remembers every single pitch. And I thought that was really, that was so interesting to hear. And I wondered if you had any sense of the, I mean, that might just be his personality. I don't know. But when you talk to your teammates and the people that you played with, you know, in these years, you know, this was, you were with them for a fairly short period of time. In many cases, you know, they would be cut and, you know, they would be gone before you could really become friends with them. But Do you have a sense of their recollections? You know, do they, they may not have kept journals, so they may not remember detail, but How did the other people, other guys in your teams that you spoke to, how do they feel about that period in their lives?
Well, David, let me take a first question, because it's an interesting point that Ron Darling's making. And I think that you remember the really good games and the really bad games. And there is something about memory being kind of linked, so it becomes more indelible when there are adrenaline involved. And it may be that really good games and really bad games produce a little bit more adrenaline than ordinary games. What I find with players is that they almost always remember home runs, or pitchers would remember, you know, shutouts or no hitter if they had one. And likewise, I mean, I can remember, you know, really abysmal performances, probably because of embarrassment and maybe because of the time you spend reflecting.
Right.
And maybe that's it. You know, maybe it's not just what happens in the game. It's sort of you have a terrible outing, you strike out three or four times in a game, and you go away and you dwell on it that night. And likewise, if you have a really good game, you get, you know, four hits, you're going to go out and celebrate and think about it. So it's maybe that's the reason that we remember those things best. In terms of your other question, was today what players remember? Is that it?
Yeah, I was kind of curious about, you know, when you talk to your teammates, not so much literally what they remember, but what do they remember? How do their memories of that time make them feel today? What do they, you know, like for you, I think in your earlier book, there was a lot of regret about what you did and didn't do. You know, you sort of felt like maybe you could have succeeded as a major league player. And of course, in this book, I don't want to give away too much of, you know, what you talked about, but on one level, you kind of came to grips with what you did and didn't do and kind of reconciled with who you were as a young man. But I wonder if others of your teammates, you know, are they frustrated still that they didn't do better, or do they look back on it as a wonderful time but kind of distant in the past? Because, you know, it's 40, 50 years later in their lives and lots of time has gone by.
Yeah, I think maybe the regrets are a little less as you get older and you come to grips with what you did with your life after baseball. I think their regrets might have been, I mean, for me, you know, the first 10 or 15 years after I got released, I didn't pay any attention to baseball at all. And probably because it was so painful for me to be reminded of how I had messed up my career. And I think a lot of guys say that, oh, I wish I had played harder, or I wish I had realized this was my one shot to sort of play well and move up and make it. And I didn't really take full advantage of it. I think that's a pretty common regret. But, the guys, I just came back a month ago from the Detroit Tigers reunion with 100 guys, Hall of Famers like Ted Kaline down to guys like me. This is the second one we've had, and it's kind of a three-day event where you spend a lot of time reconnecting with your old teammates. And there are guys, well, one thing I'll say is that they're all still ball players. Even though it's been 50 years since most of them played baseball, they still have a very strong identity of having been a ball player, and it's important to them. And they have lots of stories. I mean, they have, people are interested in baseball. People, you know, are a good audience for stories, and these guys have told these stories over and over, and they become finally honed over time, and some of them actually take on mythical proportions. But I think a lot of them are quite nostalgic about what baseball was like in the 60s. And it was a different... I think the bonds between players were stronger then, and the reason is that you didn't have it was pre-internet, pre-cell phone. You were really kind of isolated. You lived in this little bubble with your teammates, and there weren't opportunities to sort of stay connected with family and friends and girlfriends at home. Because, I mean, contacting home meant, you know, waiting, it may not have been a pay phone, but a pocket full of quarters, and it was expensive and took time, and it was just hard to do. And so what happened is that we really depended upon one another for friendship and companionship much more than players do today. And also players, I was just, you know, after this reunion was over, I spent a couple of days in Tiger Town at the Tiger Spring Training Complex, and then I did the same at the Pirates place. And what I saw, in fact, I talked to the dormitory manager, and he said that, you know, players stay in at night. And they have all of their own, you know, they've got Xbox and PlayStation and Skype and everything else. So they, you know, they entertain themselves. We didn't have that. So in the evenings, we would go out together, and we didn't hang around the barracks. We went into town and we did things together. On the road, we ate in much larger groups and we hung out together. So I think players are, many of them are kind of a little nostalgic about those times. And even the guys who had long careers and had played many years in the big leagues still talk about the best friendships they developed in baseball were in those early years in the minor league before they got married, many of them being away from home for the very first time, being insecure and being, so we were really dependent upon one another for companionship, and also to, if you were struggling, I mean, who were you going to talk to? You couldn't call home. You couldn't call a girlfriend. I think the other thing too, is in terms of, not having contact with home, is that many of us had local girlfriends. Often they were groupies who became regular girlfriends, and they were, I played altogether, counting 2 years in Canada, five seasons. And each year I got a girlfriend. And it's pretty clear from my journal that I was really looking for a female companion for the season. And within the first month of the season, each year I found somebody. And that wasn't just about sex. That was about sort of having someone to sort of confide in, to talk to. Someone who also, you know, they would sometimes make you cookies for a road trip and sew a button on or whatever. They did other more domestic things as well. So I think players have very, very fond memories of those times. Many have regrets, but about how they handled it and didn't play as hard as they could have, but think very fondly of it. Those years.
Well, and of course, the era of the 1960s. Another difference you could imagine, or I think is valid, is that the people were less worldly in the 60s. You know, they today, it's not just the internet, but television and more travel. You know, people are more accustomed to being outside of their hometown and more connected in some way. So they're less provincial. I don't mean that uniformly, but I think it's possible that that was another factor in making that period of your being together on a team more meaningful, because as you said earlier, is for a lot of those kids, it was the first time away from home. And they just didn't have any other experiences to compare it to. So you kind of cling together then, because you're all in the same boat in a sort of literal way.
Well, I think more meaningful too, in that we were seeing the country for the first time. I mean, like you say, kids today, and especially middle-class kids, they've seen a good deal of America. And when they go off to play baseball, they've been to those places before. But also then the country's become more homogenized. I mean, the South isn't as different as it was in the 60s from the rest of the country. But for us, I mean, I played, you know, I got to know chunks of the Midwest, the Northeast, the Carolinas, Florida, and then Quebec for the first time all through baseball. And even, you know, I was a middle-class kid. I hadn't been to any of those places before. And so that makes it more meaningful. And the other thing, too, that makes it really different is that the minor league ball players were much, much better paid back then. I mean, we made... minor league salaries starting out, they've actually declined when you control for inflation by 2/3.
Wow.
Major league salaries have gone up. Well, I think it's sort of the biggest income inequality in the American workplace is what's happening. It's not really well. There is a class action suit now, but it's not really well known. Major leagues, everybody hears about major league salaries, which has gone through the roof.
It
was created by 300%. Well, they've increased by 300%, whereas minor league salaries have declined by 2/3. And it's because they're not part of the union, and the union doesn't really care and doesn't do much for minor league ball players. So these guys are, you know, they're living on a shoestring, and they're depending on their parents' credit cards for them to get by. And nobody thinks of sort of a career in the minor league. I mean, they think, I'll give myself 4 or 5 years to get to the big leagues, and if not, I'm out of here. Whereas, you know, years in the 60s, you could make a career of playing in the minor leagues, and a lot of the Caribbean guys did do that.
No, it's true. In fact, there if you look at the statistics and the records of baseball players going back even a little further than the 60s, there were some guys who played in the minor leagues, might have gotten a cup of coffee here and there, but they could have 15 to 18, maybe 20 years of playing in the minor leagues. And I hadn't thought of that before, that the, you know, that it wasn't just because they couldn't think of anything else to do. They were actually able to do something they loved and make enough money at it to, you know, to almost make a living.
Yeah, I mean, well, when I, in 1965, when I signed, the standard contract was $500 a month. In today's dollars, that's $3,700 a month. The kids who signed last year signed for $1,100 a month, right? So,
wow.
So I mean, there's no way. And, right. And I remember having, you know, guys in their mid-30s, particularly from, well, those days from Cuba, but also the DR and Puerto Rico, you know, who were very happy playing minor league baseball. And they could make more money and save money than they could going home to those places where, unless you had family connections, you weren't going to do nearly as well.
Well, you know, I was really struck by what you talked about being young players, you know, and you had black kids and Hispanic players. Now you're in the early, you know, mid 60s in places that were, you know, somewhat racist, to be honest. And those were some pretty powerful stories, I thought. And of course, you know, you had your own particular run-in. I thought that was an amazing anecdote. I don't know whether you want to tell it because, you know, it might be, people should find it out by reading the book. But, you know, you had some direct experiences with Southern racism. And I, you know, at that period of time, it was still only a few years after the desegregation laws had been passed.
Yeah, well, Jim, I mean, this was, I first went to the Carolina League in 66 and then again in 67. So it's 2 years after the Civil Rights Act, but Jim Crow is still in effect. And for, you know, I had grown up in a suburb of San Francisco that was all white and middle class, and really I didn't know anything about racism or about segregation, really. So I was blown away by it, and you know, arriving there and seeing black fans having to sit in a separate section screened off by chicken wire, in which people called the coal bin, and having separate restrooms and separate concessions and you know, separate drinking fountains and all of that. And then seeing my teammates, you know, when we are on the road and sometimes would stop during the night to eat, not always being able to eat with us, and sometimes having to stay on the bus and us taking food out to them. And so, so I wound up, I was writing a feature once every month for this newspaper, and I wrote an article about it. And in that article, I mentioned that the police chief was a member of the Ku Klux Klan, which a teammate from that area had told me, and that his brother was the area Grand Dragon. And anyway, that was sort of the beginning of the end of my career, because it resulted in somebody sent a copy of that article both to the police chief and to the Chamber of Commerce, and they were furious. I mean, I believe I was right, but and I've looked into it since. But they complained to Detroit, and Detroit sent me. We were on a road trip and sent me back to Rocky Mountain. And within a week, I was released. And apparently there was a deal made where the police chief dropped his threat of a libel suit in exchange for Detroit getting rid of me. Now, had they had big money invested in me, they probably would have moved me to some other team, but they didn't, and I was probably no longer a prospect. I had a really good year the year before. I was a prospect then, but that year I was struggling. So that was the end. I mean, it's hard to know how things might have turned out had I not wound up in that league at that time, but.
Well, it is, and it is a, you know, and probably still is somewhat of a brutal system, you know, that there's not much room for error. And, when you kind of become a liability of any kind, it's easier for the, you know, because there are so many players potentially, it's just, it's a buyer's market. So you become just fodder at that point.
Yep, that's absolutely right. I could see when after this happened that they put me on, they benched me, and I'd been the cleanup hitter to that point. And then over the course of a week, they were trying to find a new first baseman. And I didn't really get it right away. I mean, I knew I was in trouble, but I somehow couldn't imagine them really getting rid of me, because I'd had a really good year, and I'd gotten a bat contract and a glove contract and stuff. But anyway, they found somebody, and once they did, that was the end. And then I couldn't, there were no agents in those days, but I had a sympathetic general manager called around and said to see if any other club needed a left-handed hitting first baseman. And he claims nobody did. I don't know how hard he tried, but so then I got a couple of offers to play in what was called the Quebec Provincial League, which was a pretty good independent league. And I went there and played the last 2 years, but that was the end. You know, that wasn't affiliated. There wasn't any track there going to the big league. So that was sort of the end of my dream.
Right. Well, and it's a in that way, quite bittersweet, and probably something that many of us can sympathize with, even though we, because we all have dreams of doing something that we're probably not able to ever be able to do. And I think it's, you highlighted how fragile that is and how difficult and kind of how much luck is involved in circumstance. You know, there's just so much. This is the way life is, I guess, to be trite about it. But I thought, that it was a good story in that way to, for you to, it's probably good for you to tell that story.
Oh, I think so. I don't think I told it, for many, many years. And then, I guess in doing the memoir, it was sort of, it's a big part of the memoir, but also in going back to this Tigers reunion, there were a lot of my African-American teammates because it was organized by an African-American guy who became the scouting director of the Tigers. And so I began asking them about their experiences when we were playing in the South. And I just became really intrigued at how different, because they didn't really go many places. In town, they kind of stayed in boarding houses or with families that were not too far from the ballpark, and they didn't really feel secure wandering around town the way I did. So their knowledge of these places was very, very different from mine and from many of my white teammates. And that I had never realized that. It really kind of intrigued me that, and because of that, they probably saw a little less of, they were impacted more by Jim Crow, of course. I mean, just the fact that they didn't feel comfortable moving around as much. But in some ways, they saw less of it than I did, and particularly after I became curious about it and began, you know, looking, wandering around, looking, you know, I would go in the bus station and discover that, you know, they had separate waiting rooms. And I walked across, the town was divided, and I wandered around the black section of the community on a couple of occasions, just curious about what it looked like. And so anyway, so all of that got me thinking and eventually led to my writing about that experience, which I couldn't have done and probably wouldn't have had any interest in doing years ago.
So do you feel like, you know, you've written a lot about baseball now, and is there anything else that attracts your attention aside from what you've already done? You know, is there some new or different area of baseball that interests you to write about?
No. I mean, I say that after each baseball book, I say, okay, that's it. I've got nothing else to say. And then, you know, then a few years later, something else pops up. I did actually, I've collected a lot of material on the technology of baseball. And I was thinking at one time of doing a book about, you know, the evolution of the bat, the ball, the glove, and all of that.
Yeah.
And but it's been done, and I don't know that I have anything new to say about it. I was going to go kind of look at players' relationships. I mean, it would be part of it. But apart from the history and evolution, to actually look at how players relate, and also differences in between Asian and Caribbean and American players, and how they think about and relate to and take care of their equipment. But anyway, but I've abandoned that. So that was the only other idea I had.
Well, no, that's actually an interesting idea. And I thought, I was thinking just now that maybe the way that the equipment might affect the way you think about your playing, you know, how it affects, it's not just the fetishization of it or what it means to you, but can, you know, how does the game change when the equipment enables things to happen that couldn't happen otherwise? And maybe that may not be a book. There may not be enough there to make it a book, but it is kind of interesting. Well,
yeah.
I'm sure you will find something else to write about, probably, you know, surprising you at some point.
Yeah, I'm open to it, but I mean, I don't think even, I can force it. And you know, I writing a book is a huge investment, as you know well. And so you really have to know that you're really interested in this topic and that it's going to sustain you through the several years of research and the writing. And so I have started several projects and then realized sort of, this is really not going to be that great a book, or I'm not that interested to sort of invest any more time in it and drop them. Anyway, yeah.
Well, I'm sure that something will arise for you, because baseball is still, you know, the most literary of all sports, and I think it just lends itself to storytelling in a way that no other sport enables.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you really don't find that in... Well, I think the reason is there's so much downtime in baseball. You're at the ballpark every day, and nowadays you're at the park for 8 hours, and your game only lasts 3 hours, so there's a lot of time in the clubhouse, hanging around, you know, on the field during batting practice, sitting around the dugout. And that time is really filled up, you know, talking to players. I mean, now they all want to get on their iPhones for part of it. Although I was talking to the Tigers VP of player development. He said that what they're doing now is actually restricting that. It's become a problem. He said actually they were also considering letting them have beer in the clubhouse now, because the old the old days, you sat around, there were, kind of bowl sessions after the game. You didn't rush out, rush away. And now everybody sort of showers and dresses very quickly and they disappear. And there's none of that. And so he was suggesting that maybe we reintroduce beer in limited quantities. Guys are more inclined to sit around and talk after a game.
Right. And maybe,
But I think what I'm getting at is like there's so much time and also travel time that, that baseball just lends itself to this rich kind of oral tradition that other sports don't have. I really don't know of anything like it on the PGA tour or in the tennis or in football or basketball.
No, it's true. And I mean, I think other factors too, that you play a long season, as Jim Brosnan called it, 162 games. That's, the bulk of a year. And then spring training, it ends up being 10 months together in baseball. And of course, now they train and play even more than that. And also just the nature of the sport, because it's organized, geometrically, and it has to do with time more than with territory, the way a lot of games are really they're war games. They're about taking territory, or scoring goals. Whereas baseball is much more of a, as they say, it's kind of pastoral, but it does enable. I think it connects better to storytelling because it is about time as a game.
David, I think even during the game itself, there are opportunities for talking. Like I played first base, and whenever there was a runner, I would talk. And I would talk to umpires, and they would talk to you. I mean, that you don't do that in a football game, or in a basketball game, or in a tennis match. There aren't those opportunities. So that contributes as well as all this downtime. And like you say, the players at the ballpark every day. It's a long, long season.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate talking to you, George. Thanks for taking the time. I know you're busy, you're teaching, and I appreciate your talking to me.
David, thanks. It's great. Always great talking to you. And if I do another baseball book, I'll let you know.
We will talk again. Well, thanks. This has been Writer's Cast. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to George Gmelch about his newest book, Playing with Tigers, A Minor League Chronicle of the 60s. Thanks so much. Thank you.